What would it be like to bike up to the tar sands? Embrace the air, the water, the exact environment that we envision Northern Alberta to be. There are a lot of students that come through at McMaster University that I meet that start out full of ambition, take a few years of schooling and studies, start to realize what's going on with the world, and they drop out of university. They are momentarily overwhelmed with what they're facing as their future. Some of them become activists. Some of them go out firsthand and witness what's going on in the world. One of those brave young people is Maria Follinsby, born and raised in Edmonton, Alberta, but it was not until she got to Hamilton at McMaster University that she found out what was going on with the tar sands. That's just an indication of how the news of what's going on up there is kept out of mainstream media. And sometimes, as she points out, when you're right in the middle of the situation, you accept it as a normal way to live. You don't see what's really going on. You become myopic. In today's discussion, Maria tells us first person what it was like to go by bike from the tar sands and how it changed her life.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows from the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
We're in studio today with a student, a former student at McMaster University, studying peace studies. Maria Follinsby has come into the studio to talk to us about her experience with the tar sands. She actually biked up there, which is something I can't imagine doing. What surprised me the most is you just told me you're from Edmonton, Alberta. You didn't know anything about the tar sands. Mm-hmm. 2003, you came to McMaster University because you wanted to study peace studies, and we're one of the few universities that has that course. It was when you came here that you found out about the tar sands. So why don't you start off by telling us, first I want to know why you're a student that is thinking about doing these wonderful worldly things. Were you an aware person before you left there? And wonder if you could explain what you wanted to do when you came to McMaster to study peace studies.
Okay, well, I think I grew up being, I've been an activist since I was a kid in a lot of ways. Ralph Klein was elected when I was in grade 2, and he sort of ripped through social programming in Alberta as premier, and that really mobilized me as an activist. But I think that Alberta as an oil-rich province, and Alberta as being sort of, I don't know, like revolving around the oil and gas industry, it kind of just, it becomes part of your skin and you don't really see it. The other thing is Edmonton is far away from Fort McMurray. It's far away from sort of the centers of oil production. It's actually sort of in the middle. Fort McMurray is where oil and gas excavation, at least tar sands excavation, happens. And then Calgary is the business center of the province.
Right. And how many miles away are you from it?
I think 500 kilometers north, almost.
Can you translate that into miles for our American friends? 500
right.
kilometers?
500 kilometers is maybe 300 miles, something around there, 300 and some miles. It's about a 5.5-6 hour drive.
So 6 hours
yeah,
to drive
that.
Up there. Now, you said you were an environmentalist as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So how come you didn't know about the tar sands?
I guess it hadn't become sort of the big deal that it is now. Back when the last oil boom happened before I was born, and then the OPEC crisis of the early 80s happened, and then Alberta went into like the bust part of the boom and bust cycle. And so most of the time I was growing up, the tar sands weren't being heavily mined. Like there was Syncrude and Suncor, they were operating, but other than that, there wasn't this sort of mad rush for oil, and it wasn't until the mid-2000s that's really started mobilizing more.
What were the papers in your neck of the woods saying about fuel? I mean, what were you an activist about? Ralph Klein, you mentioned. What did you not like about his policies?
Well, he's just a major social conservative and did all kinds of cuts to healthcare and education. And I mean, I remember working really hard on fighting mining projects at the base of the Rocky Mountains and in the sort of, they call them the foothills region. But, I mean, yeah, I don't really remember reading about or hearing about the tar sands at all growing up. And I think, I mean, like the identity of Alberta as being sort of oil, being run by oil, is just like, it's almost invisible because it's so omnipresent. Like it's everywhere, like the Oilers and welcome to oil country and there's oil derricks everywhere. It's really like that you kind of, I think maybe when you're steeped in it the way that I was as a kid, it was less obvious somehow.
You became an activist because Ralph Klein was doing cuts to healthcare and that, so you were like a social activist to do with poverty more so than environment?
I'd say so. I'd say that's where I began as, yeah, he was really cutting services to the social sector, healthcare and education, and that at the time felt really unfair to me. My friend and I don't know, I think that was sort of the way in, and that's when we started going to protests and becoming exposed to this. And I think social justice was more on my mind at the time, but I slowly became involved also in the environmental movement and then really began to make the connection between social and environmental justice.
You made that connection when you were a young teen before you came here?
Yeah.
Which way did you look at it? Because I have my own ways of looking at it. The poor feel the effects of every policy is what I say all the time to people.
Yeah.
You do something to the environment, it's always the poor that pay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think that, the environment affects everyone. And I think that our relationship to the land is going to influence every other, the way that we experience social relationships and personal interactions, the way we experience the government or like politics. It all comes back down to how we treat the land, and I think that...
Okay, but did you form these opinions before you came to McMaster?
I think I was getting there. I was part of the Victoria School of Students for Social Justice in high school, and we did a lot of work with people in Latin America and South America. And so a lot of that work was about land and freedom, and it was about social justice being related to people's sense of self and being part of a place.
So it was part of your high school. Did you actually go down there or did you just study it?
No, yeah. We did a lot of sort of awareness raising and fundraising. I never traveled there in high school.
So that sort of led you to looking for a direction for your future.
Yeah.
You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah. I think when I was doing research about going to university and thinking about going to university, I really struggled to find subject matter that was really fascinating to me. A lot of the sort of typical university degrees weren't very compelling, but I knew from at some point in high school that I wanted to be doing work that was good for the world. I thought about working for an NGO or being a diplomat. Or identity is really built around oil and the oil industry, and almost everyone in the province is employed in some relationship to oil and gas. Like even if you're sort of a service industry or a business sort of supplying oil and gas, everybody's got their hands tied a little bit. And it's very like independent kind of place and very suspicious, especially of the national government. And that stems back to like long ago, there's a national energy crisis or the national energy policy that Pierre Trudeau introduced in the early 80s, which caused all this resentment, basically played part of the reason that Alberta went into a recession in the 80s. And Alberta goes through these boom and bust cycles. And so I think that really sort of threatens people's security and identity. And the Alberta government is really good at spinning that as being the fault of the Liberals in Ottawa or whatever.
It's always the federal level.
Yeah. And the Alberta government, Alberta has very, very low taxes compared to the rest of Canada.
And why are they low? It's low because they don't pay any provincial tax, right?
Yeah. There's no provincial sales tax.
So there's no way, the tax is the tool, isn't it?
Yeah. I've heard it described as, Alberta described as a petro state, where because the government gets revenue from oil companies, because it doesn't need to ask citizens for as much tax. So citizens aren't paying taxes to the government, which basically means the government doesn't have to be accountable to citizens. And so in the case of Alberta, it's almost like the oil companies or the voters, because they're paying the taxes. They're paying for the, like, they're paying for the government.
That's important.
Yeah, it's really, and it means that people don't have a sense of democratic participation, and it means that it...
The only people that are paying tax are whatever money they can get from oil companies. So it mm-hmm. leaves it like a wide open Wild West territory. It's
yeah.
just unimaginable to me that, you know, a province that has so many natural resources allows themselves to be set up to exploit them
yeah.
so easily.
Yeah.
By companies and corporations who are not based in that province. They've got no local accountability at all.
Yeah. And I think it's a real fear of regulation. The National Energy Policy was the first time that sort of the Canadian government tried to impose any kind of regulatory measures on the way that oil was produced. And that wasn't the only thing that led to a recession, but that's what Alberta always blames the bust of the 80s on. And so ever since then, I think that people have been really suspicious of any kind of government intervention in resource extraction, in business. And Ralph Klein, there was a premier of Alberta in the 70s and 80s who was really popular, named Peter Lougheed. And he has talked about how irresponsible he thinks this new form of
Well, he does now.
Is. Yeah, he does now.
He didn't then.
And well, but he set up, like, he set up the Alberta Heritage Fund, which was a fund for royalties from oil and gas to go into. And he left the province with hundreds of millions of dollars that was intended to be used for social services, for sort of like heritage kind of things. So museums and national parks or provincial parks, stuff like that. And it was really important to him that the revenues from oil and gas would be returned in some way to the people of the province. And he even talked about future generations, which is really interesting, I think, because nobody talks about future generations. But he talked about making sure that this resource could be a legacy for the future generations of Albertans.
And that's the problem when you're making some policies, because the next government that comes in can just yeah. trash it, say it doesn't exist.
Yeah. And that's what happened. Ralph Klein totally squandered, and basically all these governments have been really fiscally irresponsible in a lot of ways. When Ralph Klein was in power, this was right when I was leaving Alberta, when I was 18 or 19, he sent every Albertan a check for, what was it, like $600 or something? And it was basically this idea, like, oh, I want you to personally share in Alberta's oil revenues. Here's my gift to you. But it was basically like, here, please vote for me. Like, I'm buy my vote. Vote for the Conservatives. Here's this money. And it was kind of, I mean, to me, that basically suggested, like, we're not really a province. We're not really a collective with, like, this collective pool of money. You are all individuals who should make your own decisions. And we, you know, it really implied like this lack of community, this lack of political culture when we weren't looking at this resource as something collectively shared, but rather something we could each individually profit from in some way. It was a really interesting move. But the government is very neoliberal, very sort of every person for themselves.
How many parties out in Alberta?
The government is overwhelmingly conservative. There are, in the provincial government, I think there are 12 seats that aren't conservative. Two of them are the New Democratic Party, the NDP, and then the other 10 are Liberal, I think. So there are three parties in the legislature, but, and this has been, I think it's like the last 70 years, the Conservatives have had the overwhelming majority and are basically untouchable as far as policy. And then nationally, Alberta is all Conservative except for one riding in Edmonton, which is NDP.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she won by less than 500 votes in the last federal election.
So the corporations are running that province.
Mm, yeah,
Yeah. And that's been happening for how long, as far as you know?
I don't know. I mean, I think Syncrude and Suncor have had major influence in the province since they started.
Well, that land was bought up in the 50s or the late 40s.
Yeah.
And everybody knew how difficult it would be to get the tar oil.
Yeah.
But somebody knew that it would be a valuable piece of property if they waited long enough. So
yeah.
My guess is since the late 40s or late 30s even.
Yeah. And I mean, before that, Alberta's always been an oil province. Before the tar sands really started going, there was like a lot of sour gas and natural gas and sweet crude mining in sort of south central Alberta. And so it's always, that resource has always sort of guided and decided government policy.
So it's not cattle, as a lot of people like to believe. It's not the beef industry or cowboys. It's oil.
Yeah, it's oil for sure.
So that explains a bit more to the listener why things have gone as they have and reached the situation they have. But now it's affecting the world. I mean, how can we do anything now? So we're getting back to why you – I want to get back to why you biked up there. What motivated you? You heard these speakers – they put a face on it. You've got your magic bingo button went off.
Yeah.
Did you join a group or what made you decide to actually do this? And what did you hope to do by doing it?
I guess that winter I spent a lot of time learning about and doing the background research, learning more about the tar sands. And then I decided to go back to Alberta. When I left Hamilton to go back to Alberta, I sort of, my intentions were quite vague. I was going to connect with some of the movements that I knew had been going on. In the last few years, the Sierra Club and Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network and who else? The Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, a lot of sort of big national, the Council of Canadians, a lot of big national social and environmental justice NGOs have been working and starting to do work in Alberta.
The Polaris Institute, I think.
Yeah, that's another one. And so I just decided I would go back and sort of plug into this movement, find a place.
Were you finished school?
No. I was just on pause, I guess.
You were angry.
Yeah, and I think the other thing was it made me realize, I mean, I've been thinking a lot for a few years now about our relationship to the land and how, I mean, something, a really disturbing marker of our culture is that we're not willing to fight for the land that we live in, on, you know? And I think that's the sign of a heart that's been bought and sold. And so part of it for me was the land that I grew up on is being ravaged. This river that, you know, I've seen the source of in the Rocky Mountains, and this incredible landscape that I know. And my parents are really enthusiastic outdoors people. So we used to go up to Wood Buffalo National Park. We used to go spend time in these places that were being destroyed. And so for me, it also felt like, oh, this is my land base. And these are the people that have made me who I am. I have a responsibility to them. And so I think that's what motivated me to go back. And then also just this, the closest to home that all of these huge issues I've been thinking about, like peak oil and climate change and mass extinction and, you know, loss of biodiversity and civilization, basically. It was the closest to home those issues.
And did you understand that the tar sands is maybe the tipping point for all these climate change problems?
It is. It has... Yeah, the consequences for the future, though, and I think also, I mean, the big issue, like the big climate change and sort of global impacts, are really powerful and in a lot of ways feel really scary. But for me, the things that were actually the most poignant were some of the, I mean, like the struggles of the First Nations folks in Northern Alberta. The health and quality of life impacts that those people are having, as well as the social conflicts that were taking place. I mean, Fort McMurray is the addiction capital of Canada. They say more than $7 million worth of coke is taken into the province, I mean, into the city every week. $7 million worth of cocaine. Crystal meth is a major problem. drug and alcohol addictions abound. It's also a place where there's tons of sexual abuse and abusive relationships.
Why would that be, do you think? I mean, it's out there in the boonies.
Yeah.
Why is it the capital of this drug trade?
I think it's because these people, I mean, they're basically, like the people who moved to Fort McMurray, everyone's from away. Most of the people who work in the tar sands are either foreign workers from other countries, or they come from Eastern Canada, from places that where there's high unemployment. And so people are being taken out of their communities and being put in these really high-stress, labor-intensive environments where they're working like 10 or 12 hours a day. They go back to these work camps in the middle of nowhere where all you can do is watch TV, basically. There's no sense of community there. There's no sense of relationship to the place or even to each other. Like, everything is so transient that I think there's just this lack of culture. And it's also a very young and very male population.
And these are, you said the East Coast term, they are from away, which was interesting.
Yeah.
These aren't the natives that live there. That's a native community.
Well, Fort McMurray, I guess I'm not sure what the original population would have been. Just north of Fort McMurray is a place called Fort McKay. And there are actually several reserves. There's one reserve where First Nations folks live just south of Fort McMurray. And then Fort McKay is about an hour north. And then Fort Chipewyan is another, I don't know, probably 60 or 100 miles north of that along the Athabasca. And those three communities are native. Or largely native. And a lot of those, I mean, those communities are very much embroiled. They have a really interesting relationship with oil and gas that I would say is abusive, because they depend on those companies for jobs. They depend on them for social spending. Like, these companies will come in and build playgrounds and community centers.
All right, but let's start at the start. We're talking about native communities who are notorious for living off the land.
Yeah.
They don't need a job.
Well, yeah, and that was the case until the 60s and 70s when, I mean, the testimony of some of these people is really, really powerful. The testimony of people who have been living in those communities for a long time and who have seen marked decline in muskrat populations, in moose populations, where they can actually taste a difference in the meat. They talk about being able to taste, like, the meat tastes oily all of a sudden. They see dead birds. And some of the most powerful things are the fish that people are pulling out of the river, Athabasca River, and Lake Athabasca, which is where the river empties. And these fish have been found with growths and tumors and mutations. Like, when we were up in Fort Chipewyan last summer, we saw a fish that had two jaws and all these really bizarre mutations and obvious signs of illness.
How long has that been going on, do you think?
They've talked about it as being a trend that they've really seen intensify over the last 10 or so years.
So it's when the oil company started doing this dirty oil that happened. So are we saying that the drug trade that's been going on up there has been only the last 10 years as well?
I'm not. I think that a lot of the social problems that Fort McMurray is seeing have been especially a part of the last boom. And I think that's probably influenced a lot by the sort of intensification of globalization since the last boom started. Like, the last time that there was really serious excavation going on in the tar sands, I think, was like the 70s. And then there was this bust side of the cycle. And then it really started going again in the early 2000s. And so it was at that time that all of these social problems really started making themselves visible and manifest in the community of Fort McMurray.
So why choose to bike up there? What was the point of biking? And where did you start from?
Well, when I came back to Alberta, I got a job working for the Sierra Youth Coalition, which is sort of the youth branch of the Sierra Club of Canada. And it's explicitly an environmental justice organization. So the Sierra Youth Coalition is really working to work in solidarity with people defending the land. And it does a lot of different kinds of work, really a lot of work on climate change. And they were really interested in participating in this movement against the tar sands. And the year before, two summers ago, there was a bike trip organized that went from
What year was that? 2001?
2007. The summer of 2007, a bike trip went from the U.S.-Canadian border in Waterton Lakes National Park, which is just, it's on the border between Alberta and Montana. And they biked from Waterton Lakes all the way to Fort McMurray. And that was a Sierra Youth Coalition trip. And they decided to do sort of another one, and they hired me to coordinate it. So I spent my summer organizing the trip and then was one of the cyclists who was on it.
What were you guys going to do once you biked up there?
Well, our plan, we actually biked the opposite direction. So we biked from Fort McMurray to Calgary the second time.
How did you get to Fort McMurray first?
We drove up in a van with our bikes.
Why go that way? Why go backwards? And so the experience of Fort McMurray is what I'm interested.
Yeah.
When you got there, let's talk about what your experience was personally.
Okay. We decided to go the other way because we wanted to have that testimony as sort of the beginning of the trip and be able to carry those stories and those experiences with us. And we also, we collected water from the Athabasca River in water bottles, and we're taking it to political and business leaders across the province and demanding that they take responsibility for what this water represented, I guess, in terms of environmental destruction and the health impacts.
Did you take a two-jawed fish with you?
No. I wish. No, they kept that in Fort Chippewa. But, yeah, so... So that was sort of why we started going the other way. And the experience, we got to Fort McMurray and then went, we actually flew to Fort Chippewa. Fort Chip is a community, it's one of the communities that has experienced the most intense health impacts of the tar sands so far. And it's about, I'd say it's maybe 100 miles north of Fort McMurray, maybe more actually. And you can't access it by road in the summer. You can only access it by plane because it's nestled in the Peace Athabasca Delta, which is this huge freshwater delta. So it's all wetlands and bogs, and it's you can't really build a road there. So there's only an ice road in the winter, and in the summer you can fly. And there was something called the Keepers of the Water Conference happening while we were there. So we attended this... It was almost a week long. I think it was a 5-day long conference that was bringing together people who lived all the way along the Athabasca River basin and people who lived in the Delta. So anyone who was being impacted in some way by the quality of the water in the Athabasca River. And it was bringing together those people and NGOs to talk about how to keep the water safe and talk about people's experiences and hearing that kind of testimony.
Excellent.
Yeah. And that was a really powerful experience. Fort Chip is a community of about 1,000 people. In the last 3 years, they've lost at least 6 community members to an incredibly rare and very virulent form of cancer called bile duct cancer, which usually hits about 1 in 100,000 people. But there have been 6 cases of this rare cancer in a community of 1,000. And it's been linked to oil and gas. The doctor in their community, who's actually from Nova Scotia, only knew about this particular kind of cancer because his father had it as a result of working in the Sydney tar ponds.
He was aware. He was kicked out of the medical community as a result.
Yeah, he experienced this amazing controversy when he went public with this story and basically pointed fingers at oil companies in Alberta for poisoning the people in Fort Chippewa. He was threatened with his license being taken away. His name was kind of slandered across the media. He lost all this legitimacy. Really stressful situation. There's a great film about him called Downstream, actually, that I think you can stream online. So this community has really seen, and they've also been sort of observing these long-term changes in the land.
If these communities where you gather the information from or you have to fly in and out, why bike when you get to Fort? You know, what are you going to see when you're biking along hundreds of miles of wilderness?
I guess there were a few reasons for doing the bike trip. Part of it is trying to embody in at least a small way and recognizing all the sort of hypocrisies that come along with it, trying to embody an alternative and talking about ways that we can reduce our dependency on oil. I think another reason that we biked was it has this impact, and it really intrigues people. And what it meant was that people would be pulling over to the side of the road to talk to us. It meant that we were sort of already on the level of the populace, and we really wanted it to be about dialogue and really wanted it to be about sharing this personal testimony. And so, I don't know, being on that level actually was really effective. When you're in cars or other means of transport, I guess, like you're sort of boxed in and you don't get that human communication.
So I guess people would freak out when they see people on bikes up there.
Yeah.
Wondering what you're doing.
Yeah. A lot of people were really shocked. And Fort McMurray, like we biked from the city of Fort McMurray out to the mines, which is on what they call the Highway of Death, which is a highway where there's usually like 4 or 5 accidents a day. A 20-mile commute takes you 4 hours because there's so many cars because of these accidents, because the highway is so bad.
Is it busy or?
Yeah. It's basically people are commuting from the city of Fort McMurray out to the mines where they work.
So there's so much traffic. It's called the Highway of Death now.
Yeah.
Because it's just jammed with various employees coming from whatever community to go into the tar sands. While we're on that, a lot of the people that are employed at the tar sands, I mean, they're like slave labor. They're coming from different countries.
Mm-hmm. Another one of the major issues with the tar sands is labor issues. The Canadian government has basically streamlined the process for accessing foreign labor in something called the Temporary Foreign Labor or Temporary Foreign Workers Program. And these people can be brought into the country for usually a maximum of 6 months to do work. And mostly, often these people are sort of citizenship is dangled in front of them. It's like this little temptation, like, oh, if you come, you might be able to apply for permanent resident status or citizenship afterwards. And often there are recruiters in other countries, illegal recruiters, but people will pay these people to help them get access to the Temporary Foreign Workers Program so that there are people making thousands of dollars soliciting workers in other countries. And then often these people are not educated about their rights, especially not in their own language. Safety is a bigger issue and adequate training, because a lot of these people just haven't had access to the same, or they haven't had access to training in their language. There have been several deaths associated with temporary foreign workers in the tar sands.
Because they get sick?
Yeah. And so there's a lot of issues with the program. And it also, a lot of these people are not in unions. And so it's much harder to fight for your rights. There was a story last summer about a man from China who basically was never paid for his work. And another story about someone who was killed and then his family didn't have access to his wages. So there's a lot of exploitation that takes place.
So what about all these East Coasters that are running to the tar sands for money? Because the fishery industry is dead now.
Well, and that's what's interesting, is this one resource was overexploited. The eastern fisheries resource was exploited by people to the point of collapse, and then everyone became unemployed, and now they're all commuting from Newfoundland to Alberta, literally like a 6-7 hour flight as a commute that people do every 2 weeks or something like that, like really crazy lifestyle basically, to hyper exploit another resource.
So these people that came in from Newfoundland and from the coast because they have no jobs, thinking they're going to make, I don't know, what dollars an hour, an outrageous hourly rate, thinking they're going to get rich.
Yeah.
And in reality, what happens to them?
Well, the lifestyle in Fort McMurray is really expensive. There's a housing crisis, and so rent is sky high. Food even is really expensive up there, especially because it's so far north. There's no local food production at all. Everything is brought in. What we talked to a lot of people about is they would come and they would expect to make $120,000 a year, but then they would end up buying a huge pickup truck, which would cost them $80,000, and then they'd be in debt again. And gambling is a serious issue, and drug and alcohol addictions.
Why would they buy a huge pickup truck? Is that all they could buy?
That's just just what everybody does. I think it's a really – the tar sands is a really interesting example of mass delusion and denial in a lot of ways. The people who work there are – I mean, everybody involved is kind of lying to themselves. And, you know, they talk about how you stop smelling the air after you've lived there for a few months. But
– I wanted to ask you, what does the air smell like when you
– It smells like asphalt. It really – it smells –
Can you breathe it? I mean, people are getting used to it, but can you actually breathe it at first?
When we were up there, when we were biking from the town of Fort McMurray to the mines, we all had bandanas over our faces because it was really painful. It was actually hard on our lungs, and I developed a cough over the, like, 5 days that we were in Fort McMurray. My body was really unhappy with the air quality. It's really, really poor air quality, for sure. It smells like the road is always being paved or something like that, you know, when you walk past.
It's like when somebody's tarring their roof.
Yeah, yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
My God. So the water is obviously it's brought in?
I'm not sure.
What about the food and water then, if the air was that bad?
Well, I think it's too far north for there to be much farming. The land isn't appropriate for farming. So I think that probably all the produce is brought in. And the water, I'm not sure where they get water in Fort McMurray, whether they would get it downstream of the tar sands from the river.
You mean upstream, right?
Right, yes. Upstream. I mean upstream. I always confuse those.
Well, it's confusing because the rivers run north. So, the automatic precept is that rivers all run from north to south.
Right.
They run in any direction they need to run. Where do the – it ends up in the Lake Athabasca, which is what? It's one of the largest freshwater lakes.
Yeah, it's the largest freshwater lake in Alberta and one of the largest in the country. And from Lake Athabasca, it runs – it runs in two directions, actually. Some of the water will go north all the way to the Beaufort Sea, which is where Alaska meets Canada. And then the other branch of the river runs east towards Hudson's Bay. So eventually the river ends up emptying into two different oceans.
That's nice. So completely pollute after a period of time, two separate bodies of fresh water.
Yeah.
Fresh water, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you did this bike run and you survived it. You've obviously done some damage to your health as a result. Why did you come back to Hamilton then after experiencing all of that?
I think part of it was like personal decision about feeling like Hamilton was a This is ironic because Hamilton is not necessarily a very healthy city, but it was an emotionally maybe healthier city for me to live in. I was also interested in figuring out ways to bring the issue of the tar sands to a wider audience, because something that I realized living in Hamilton was how isolated I had been from the issue and also how little people in this part of the country know about it, despite the fact that the impact is international in scope. I mean, the consequences of the tar sands are international. And there are very direct connections between Alberta and Ontario. There are pipelines going into Sarnia right now, refinery projects happening around the Great Lakes.
So why not go to Sarnia and fight that?
Well, I guess just Hamilton was my adopted home.
Okay, so you found activists here. You found an outlet. You found, you had to go back to school, right? You went back to school?
Yeah, so, I guess there were a lot of things that were sort of calling me back to this place, but I was interested in making those connections. And this spring, I was part of a group of people who organized a conference in Hamilton about the tar sands that was trying to just, look at it as a local issue, as a local concern. And it's hard to do that, actually. It's hard to make it feel... it was even hard for me to talk to people in Edmonton about it in a way that would make them personally implicated and concerned by it. And so bringing the issue to Ontario has been a challenge, and I do definitely feel less connected to it than I did living in Alberta, but I don't know. I think there's still ways. It's still an important...
Well, the pipelines touch Sarnia, so it's touching Lake Erie.
Yeah. And the air pollution from – there are refineries slated for sort of throughout Illinois, Chicago, sort of like the southern part of the Great Lakes.
Let's talk about the pipelines.
Yeah. There have been multiple pipeline projects approved. Enbridge is the biggest sort of pipeline company, and they have been building pipelines from the north, from the Mackenzie Valley, to bring natural gas to the tar sands, and then out west to the west coast, and then down to California and Texas, and then across Canada and down into the Great Lakes region. The American Senate has just approved a new pipeline project going into the states, and so the major infrastructure of dependence on tar sands fuel is in place and is getting bigger and bigger all the time.
And now that's frightening to me because with the amount of water, fresh water, I don't know why they keep using fresh water. I guess there's a reason. I wish they would find some other way. But the amount of fresh water that they use, so they have to be on a lake. So look, we have these lovely Great Lakes, yep. Fresh water.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they're an endless supply of fresh water. But what most people do not know is that they're like a bowl. It's a bowl. And mm-hmm. when the Arctic ice caps and whatever rivers up there melt, the water comes into the Great Lakes, all five of them. And that's where it stays. And mm-hmm. then eventually it runs out to the Atlantic Ocean. That's the drinking water for so many thousands of people. Mm-hmm. It's non-renewable. That's what people don't understand. It's not always going to be there. It's not always going to be clean. It just sits there.
Yeah.
It just sits there, and we pull drinking water from it, and we put sewage back into it. So now we've got refineries. I mean, that approving the Alberta Clipper has really given the go-ahead to Murphy Oil, and Murphy Oil has been sitting on Lake Superior making mistakes in the water there for 40 years or 60 years, quite a long time. I do know that Enbridge and some of the companies, BP owns Murphy Oil, and British Petroleum spent, I don't know, billions of dollars trying to remarket their image as no longer British Petroleum,
right.
But
beyond petroleum.
Beyond petroleum.
Yeah.
They're so green. I've seen the ads. And now that the Senate has said, okay, well, yeah, you can build these pipelines. The pipelines have been in place for many years. That's what I need people to know. These mm-hmm. pipelines have been there. It's backwards. You don't get approval first and then you start building. You start building and then you hand the carrot to the legislators, lobbyists, government, whatever, and say, look at all the money that you will get and all
yeah.
the jobs that will come if you let us just finish this little bit,
yeah.
this little remaining bit of pipeline. So all the billions of dollars that at one point these oil companies were forced to think about alternatives and actually had environmental staff hired to market, they just said, we're not going to do that anymore. Threw it right out the window. And now all these billions of dollars are going into old refineries like mm-hmm. Murphy Oil sitting on Superior, Wisconsin, I believe it is, tiny town that's now going to experience the same sort of thing you were just discussing.
Weird boom, yep.
So that was a really bad decision.
Yeah. And there's just northeast of Edmonton is a town called Fort Saskatchewan, which is where a lot of tar sands fuel gets upgraded. And they call it Cancer Alley or Upgrader Alley. And the health impacts for that community and the impacts on farmland, I mean, taking away prime Alberta farmland for oil refineries for these expansion projects, cattle and other animals have been experiencing these health impacts. And we're just basically bringing more of that to other parts of the world, other parts of North America. The other thing is air quality as a result of refineries is really serious. They'll be taking water out of the Great Lakes and pumping major carbon emissions into the air. And, I mean, we already live in smog town. We already live...
Somebody was telling me about acid rain, I think in northern Saskatchewan, so bad that some of the lakes are dead now, from what you're talking about, by putting all these poisons into the air.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about I couldn't speak to that specifically, but it's, you know, the consequences, we need clean air and clean water to live. That's the bottom line.
And food. So now we're polluting our air.
Yeah.
We're polluting our water. And now we're also polluting our food.
Yeah. It has major consequences for farmland.
The three things we need to live.
Yeah.
All for oil and gas so we can drive an SUV.
Yeah.
Wow.
And keep fighting wars on foreign soil and maintain the industrial growth economy.
All right. I'm an American. I want my SUV. I think this is a wonderful idea that I can now, I have this wonderful oil coming to me all the way from who knows where. I don't care. I'm in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about changing my lifestyle. I don't have to worry about my future. I don't know anything about it. What do you have to say to people like that?
I don't know. I think we're all in this together at this point. There's no room for individualism or selfishness anymore, especially because we're talking about climate change and we're talking about the collapse of the biosphere, basically, on so many levels. I mean, there are a lot of people who are in denial about climate change, but there are other reasons. There are other very compelling. If you don't want to believe in climate change, which I would suggest is a mistake, because we really need to be doing something to curb carbon emissions for the sake of the health of the future of the planet. There are other really compelling reasons not to be living this way anymore. Dependency on foreign oil is a security issue, and for a lot of reasons. And I mean, Canada and America are pretty inextricably linked, and there's NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Security and Prosperity Partnership that are going to make politics complicated for this continent.
Well, let's talk about NAFTA wasn't discussed, from my understanding, at the most recent meeting in Mexico. I'm not sure about that. But I do, you know, I follow the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and the superhighway. Nobody seems to be interested in that big superhighway, but when I look at the two maps of these pipelines, you look at the map of the pipelines, which you can easily see if anybody wants to just go to Enbridge, they'll gladly have a map there that you can click on and see what they propose, which means they've already built it. They're just waiting for the stamp, the official legal stamp. And then you go to NASCO, the people that are really proud about that superhighway going straight up the center of the U.S., and they're on top of each other. Don't tell me this is not a plan that was conceived for 50 years. I find it just too hard to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's infrastructure for basically Fortress North America, I think, in a lot of ways. And it's infrastructure for making sure that resources can travel from marginalized and low population centers into centers of power.
So they're pulling from Canada and they're pulling from South America into, I really find it hard to think of, no offense to people in Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas.
Yeah.
Where is the center of power, do you think?
I don't know.
I know Texas is where a lot of this happens. Mm-hmm. And I do know there's been a lot of independent films on YouTube, which is amazing. Some kid goes down to Laredo, Texas, right on the border of Mexico, and films the highway, which is like it is 8 lanes wide. And it's got a big fence along it, and it's for planes to land and cars to drive and trucks to drive.
Yeah.
So if they've got this big highway right through the center of the states, and they're pulling oil and resources from South America and from Canada, why build a pipeline? I don't understand it. It's only 4 feet under the surface of the soil.
Hmm. I think that the pipeline, it's, I don't know, maybe it's an easier form of transportation, or maybe it's just another cash grab for another company, you know, another way of, I don't know, exploiting or developing. They might claim that it's more jobs.
Oh, they always claim it's more jobs.
Yeah.
But it never happens that way. It makes me really wonder when the water rises, and the water will rise because the melting ice has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
The coastlines are going to disappear. And I've heard many different stories about how many feet it's going to rise. But it looks to me, when I look at that NASCO map, I think they don't care about the coastlines. Coastlines are all going to be running for the center of the continent.
Yeah.
What about people coming in from other lands that will be underwater?
Yeah. It's going to be really messy, I think. The sort of the collective crises that we're facing.
But somebody's preparing for it.
Yeah. But and then the other really interesting thing is the relationship. I mean, the Security and Prosperity Partnership ensures the free movement of goods and resources across the continent, but at the same time is working on restricting the movement of people. I mean, Canada is beginning to arm its border, and the U.S. border with Mexico is, a fortress, is impenetrable, or they're working on making it impenetrable anyway. So is that really free trade? Or maybe that's the definition of free trade, is the free movement of goods and services at the restriction of human beings.
Let's talk about the Arctic. You know, here's Harper up there. Everybody's busy planting a flag.
Yeah, yeah.
Missing the obvious point. So obviously they don't care about – the ice is just getting in the way of mineral rights.
Yeah. And Canada, that's a really disturbing fact, is Canada's in the short term maybe going to benefit from climate change if the Northwest Passage opens up and they can start this deep sea drilling for more oil and natural gas in the Arctic. That will, in the short term, be very beneficial for Canada. And it really is. It's about resources, that whole fight
for the Arctic.
It's
about money.
Yeah. And it's not about protecting a way of life. It's not about the people who live up there. It's not, I don't know.
We're making assumptions. We have to say some statement that's true.
Yeah.
You've been to the tar sands. You've seen what's going on. You've seen first-person testimony. You've gotten active. You come back. And so now you're back in Hamilton trying to educate other people who haven't seen what you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And we can speculate. We can look at things. As I say, I look at different sites for businesses and add them up and conclude certain things. But I spend a lot of time researching and talking to people like you. So I have a perspective that's already ahead of the game. But so do the pipelines. When you look at the pipelines, when you're talking about the Arctic, you look at the pipelines. That's your map. Mm-hmm. Why are they building a pipeline to the Arctic?
The Arctic pipelines, there's one that goes basically to the Mackenzie Valley, and there's maybe another one that they're trying to push through the Alaska Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah.
Both those pipelines will be transporting natural gas from the Arctic to the tar sands.
So how do you and I, people like ourselves that are aware of this stuff, how do we make other people understand? How do we stop these pipelines?
Yeah.
Because we know the demand for pipelines means it's going to increase the dirty oil coming out of the tar sands. It's going to increase the loss of fresh water. It's going to increase all the things we've talked about.
Yeah.
Threefold, maybe more. I read a statement online from a Texan who was so happy because now he would see 300,000 barrels a day coming his way.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about that, we haven't even reached 270,000 barrels a day coming out of the tar sands. So if we increase that polluter, we've killed ourselves.
Yeah.
How do we get people to understand that these tar sands are not – these pipelines are not the answer, that if we want to keep fresh water, if we want to be able to drink and eat our cows in the field.
Yeah.
What do you tell young people like yourself who say, I've quit school?
Right, to go work up north.
I've talked to a lot of students that have said that. They start out in their 3-year or 4-year plan here for action, and they quit school once they find out certain things. But what, you know, how can you change things? What do you hope to do to change things?
I think there are a lot of angles that we can take. I mean, right now there's actually some pretty hardcore resistance against the pipeline that's going from northern Alberta to northern BC. A pipeline has been bombed, an Enbridge pipeline has been bombed like 5 or 6 times now.
Doesn't that just make pollution go into the earth there?
I know. That's what's really complicated. It's not really a sustainable solution. And they just keep rebuilding it too. So, I mean, it's hard to figure out what the right course of action is for stopping pipelines. I think, and that's what was really overwhelming about the tar sands for me, was the things that I feel capable of compared to the size and scope of the problem. It just felt very unequal in a lot of ways. Because I'm convinced, I know that there are options and possibilities for totally transforming the way that we live. And there's all kinds of really interesting ideas about communities and lifestyles and all appropriate technology that will allow us to live in a sustainable relationship with the planet. And I think we really need to start thinking about that. And I mean, you know, like earthworks and permaculture and bioremediation, these sort of small scale things. And maybe we need to be creating the alternatives in the small scale communities that can demonstrate to people why we don't need and can get away from an addiction to oil. But yeah.
What films would you suggest people take a look at?
To learn more about the tar sands, Downstream is a great film. There's a film made about the first bike trip called To the Tar Sands. That's also a really excellent film. And if we want to talk about the bigger issues like the Industrial Growth Society, there's a great movie called What a Way to Go, which is sort of the philosophy that challenges the philosophy of the Industrial Growth Society. To educate yourself more about the facts on the tar sands, Oil Sands Truth and Tar Sands Watch are great.
Okay. Well, we're pretty much out of time. I do want to put a plug in for Age of Stupid. The Age of Stupid is an amazing documentary that has been put together by a handful of volunteers and one very intense director-writer who has taken over the UK, actually gotten into legislature in the UK and Scotland, and that's where they're from. They went to Australia and New Zealand, and now they're in the States. Huh. That is the new Inconvenient Truth. Age of Stupid shows what happens to the survivors of the crash of everything. Huh. It's a strong, strong statement that to you and I seems obvious, and that's why it's called The Age of Stupid. I would suggest anybody, if you're interested, just log on, search for Age of Stupid. You can go to my website, little plug here, www.oside.ca, and you'll find a little bit of a video and you'll find a link. And I want to thank you very much for coming in today and talking about what it's like to be a young person facing all of this, what you're trying to do about it, how you're trying to inform people, and you're going to do that a little bit with today's discussion. So thanks very much for coming
in. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
That was Maria Follinsby.
There are new questions about Canada's biggest producer of greenhouse gases, the Alberta oil sands. Our colleagues at Radio Canada's Zone Libre have uncovered plans for a dramatic expansion, in part to satisfy an American objective. Guy Gendron has the story.
America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world.
George W. Bush surprised many observers a year ago with his blunt assessment and his newly set goal to drastically reduce oil imports from the Middle East. Executives from American oil multinationals and Canadian oil sands producers met for 2 days with representatives from both governments. They made plans for a five-fold expansion in oil sands production in a relatively short time span. That would mean 5 million barrels a day, a quarter of current American consumption, and almost half of all U.S. imports.
Although he did not mention Canada, that is, in fact, where the replacement supply will come from.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They learn much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a What a wonderful way.
Ooh, yeah. This is The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU FM. I am your host, Maggie Hughes. Thanks for listening.
Redefining radio.
CFMU.